Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Former Congresswoman Corinne Brown is found guilty of 18 charges related to a bogus charity.
So, in terms of what it's doing to the community, it's just further dividing us.
Florida's budget may be done, but some last-minute deal-making casts a cloud over the legislature's work.
The agreement with the House was we would take their bill and they would take our bill.
And as Florida works to rebuild its beaches from the 2016 storm season, the state's coastline is under threat from another source, melting sea ice. I'm Lynn Hatter in for Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Ryan Bank joins us this evening from Florida Public Radio member station WJCT in Jacksonville. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us tonight on Capitol Report. You've been covering the trial of former Congresswoman Corinne Brown. She was found guilty of about 18 of 22 charges related to a bogus charity scheme. Walk us back. How did this get started?
Well, it got started with an indictment on 22 counts. Of course, this all stems from her role in One Door for Education, which the government alleged was a bogus charity that raised more than $800,000 from donors. And it was done under the auspices that it was going to provide scholarships for disadvantaged children, particularly here in the Jacksonville area. Only about $1,200 actually made it to two different students. And one of those students was actually the grandson of a very close associate of Corinne Brown, the grandson of Richard Danford, who is the Urban League president here in Jacksonville. The prosecutors gathered evidence for years. This investigation began under the Obama administration. There were hundreds and hundreds of pages of exhibits, everything from copies of checks to FedEx slips to emails to bank transfers and even to actual security footage from ATMs showing Brown taking out money just in some cases 20 minutes after One Door money was deposited into her account. And so this is how we got here.
Wow. You know, when she was on the campaign trail just last year during a campaign stop, she continued to say, you know, she was clean. She was innocent. She called this sort of a political witch hunt. In fact, we have some audio of that here.
Are you confident
that
when this is
resolved,
you'll come out clean?
Oh, I am clean. Goodness, clean. Yes.
So obviously, you know, the jury has said obviously not too clean. What's next for Brown after this?
Well, you know, I just want to mention she still maintains her innocence. Although she did not speak herself after the verdict, her lawyer, James Smith, who is based out of Orlando, did read a brief statement from Brown. And I believe that we have some sound of that as well.
You take on the pain and everything else that your client goes through. And so obviously this is a disappointing result, but I've been doing this long enough to know that this is just part one.
And so basically what Smith is saying here, he's alluding to the fact that he will be filing a motion for a new trial. There's a lot of speculation on what grounds he might use to file this motion. Judge Timothy Corrigan is the judge presiding. If that motion is rejected, we will see it'll take at least 90 days, if not more, with some extensions. for him to make a decision on Brown's sentencing. We also know that Corrigan has to make a decision about the sentencing of her former chief of staff, Elias Ronnie Simmons, and the former president of Wendorf Education, Carla Wiley, who both agreed to testify against her. Simmons mentioned on the stand during cross-examination that he was and is hoping through this plea agreement with the prosecution for a lighter sentence in exchange for cooperation. So this could take at least 3 months, but it could be pushed out even further. We've seen trials like this go on back and forth, or cases like this go on back and forth for years. So there's still a lot up in the air.
How is Jacksonville taking this? Corrine Brown, almost 25 years in Congress, 24 years in Congress. She is a Jacksonville institution. How have the results, the guilty verdicts here, sort of affected the cities? How are people reacting to this?
Well, it's just done nothing to heal age-old divisions in this city. This city has, as many cities in the South do, has a very long history of racism and schisms within racial schisms within the community. You have a lot of her hardcore supporters who have been supporting her day in and day out throughout the trial and are still supporting her now. They're calling this a witch hunt. They're saying that she's being targeted. They're saying that, or at least alluding to the fact that because of her stature as a powerful, historic black woman figure in Jacksonville, that she's being targeted while others are walking free. Of course, Corrine Brown had to sue just to get her district in 1992, and she was one of a small class of black congressional leaders that were the first ones elected since Reconstruction in the South from Florida. So there's a lot of feelings that are being dredged up. Those on the right who have always had kind of this antipathy for her, particularly those that are activists or regular citizens on the right, not so much the political class. They just see this as a huge win, and they're sort of celebrating. So, in terms of what it's doing to the community, it's just further dividing us.
Ryan Bank with WJCT in Jacksonville. Thank you so much for joining us tonight on Capitol Report. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lynn.
The Florida legislature has passed its budget and gone home, but the manner in which lawmakers closed out this year's session is raising a number of questions about process, a special session, and the veto pen. Nick Evans has more.
On the final day of the 2017 legislative session, state lawmakers took up 18 last-minute proposals: the budget and its implementing bill, a tax cut package, and 15 conforming bills. Some of those measures, like one establishing an advisory group to make recommendations on maintenance at the Capitol, aren't controversial. But others, like a massive education overhaul and a measure tying together state worker raises and benefit reform, raised hackles, especially in the Senate.
The agreement with the House was we would take their bill and they would take our bill.
That's Senate Budget Chief Jack Latvala, explaining a deal trading the House pre-K-12 proposal for the Senate's higher ed bill.
They got a little carried away with their bill. And perhaps it went a little further than a bill should have gone in the conforming bill process based on the rules of the Senate, based on our policies, and based certainly on my preference. For that, I will take the responsibility.
Lawmakers can't amend conforming bills, which makes them an ideal vehicle for leaders in one chamber or another to slip policy that wouldn't otherwise pass onto the other chamber's floor.
Now, some of you were here with me in 2011, when on the last night of session, we had a regular full-scale throwdown on conforming bills.
This is a serious issue. I would probably agree with the results of most of this report, but I don't agree with the process of how we got there.
It's 2011, and Seminole Republican Senator Dennis Jones is voicing the same concerns many lawmakers were voicing at the close of 2017's session.
I think We need to send a lesson back to the House. Turn this bill down, and in the future, if you're going to have a deregulation, do it the right way. Put a House bill in, put a Senate bill in, get the public input, get it referred to two or three committees, vote it up or vote it down, but don't come around the back door and have it only done in one House and then expect us to swallow it.
And the justifications at the time are eerily familiar, too. Here's former Niceville Republican Don Gates addressing another of the 43 conforming measures lawmakers took up in 2011.
As to the substance, the specific items that that Senator Bogdanoff mentioned were all discussed in conference and included in our deliberations in conference.
Now, House Speaker Richard Corcoran in 2017.
No, I think most everything in that bill has been vetted, and if it hasn't been vetted, it's been discussed at different levels of the committee process.
The pre-K-12 measure Corcoran is talking about here is the same bill Latvala was apologizing for at the beginning. But just like the conforming bill Gates defended in 2011, significant portions of the House bill never passed Senate committees. Instead, leaders placed their priorities in conforming bills, forcing an up or down vote and dealing one measure for another. And when reporters asked Governor Rick Scott about potentially vetoing the entire budget, he criticized the backroom dealing.
I have the opportunity to veto the entire budget, or I can go line by line through the budget. There's 4,000 lines in the budget. Now, this is a budget that was done in secret. We're just learning about what's in the budget. But I will be going through every line, and I'll make the best decision for all the citizens of the state, no different than what I've done the last 6 years.
Somewhere in all the wheeling and dealing, important issues got left by the wayside, none more glaring than medical marijuana. Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley says he wants to address the issue sooner rather than later.
You know, at the latest next session, and if we addressed it before then, that wouldn't hurt my feelings either. The one big regret I have of session, because listen, sometimes bills don't pass. That's part of it. But that's one that is a real regret of session.
Now, amid growing public pressure, 71% of voters did approve a medical marijuana amendment. House Speaker Richard Corcoran is voicing support for a special session. Senate President Joe Negron is a bit more ambivalent, soliciting recommendations from his members before making any public pronouncements. Governor Scott can call a special session if he wants, but if Negron and Corcoran can agree on a joint proclamation, they can call lawmakers back to Tallahassee too. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida hospitals are closely following healthcare negotiations between the state and federal government. They're worried about further healthcare funding cuts, but lobbyist Jennifer Ungaroo says she's excited for the state to have more flexibility to create a customized Medicaid program.
The way that we're going to make healthcare more accessible is if it's affordable.
And we'll get the latest on the newest body camera bill approved by the Florida legislature. Some say it increases transparency, but others worry footage could be manipulated.
The camera was put on the officer not just to surveil the officer or the subject. It was put on there as a tool to make sure you're accurate and you're transparent. Allowing the officer to review that footage gives transparency and it gives accuracy.
Florida lawmakers have carved out $50 million to shore up the state's beaches, the largest appropriation in a decade. But as Kate Payne reports, some conservationists were hoping for more changes to how the state preserves its coastline.
Last year, Floridians were given a stark reminder that many of us live our lives on shifting sands. Portions of coastal highways in Flagler, St. John's, and Franklin counties collapsed. Here's some footage of a longtime resident walking along a crumbling A1A road in the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew.
Living here your whole life and, you know, seeing many storms, but never imagined this would happen.
Those beaches that were restored performed remarkably.
Diana Ferguson represents the Florida Shore and Beach Preservation Association. She says the storms pinpointed the coast's weak areas.
If you look at some of the other beaches in that area that weren't nourished, you'll see tremendous damage, all kinds of property damage.
Besides periodic storms, gradual erosion is a constant threat. Dawn Pardo is a Riviera Beach City Councilwoman. She's worried her town's tourism industry could disappear.
I don't come from a very wealthy city, and it is imperative that we get as many tourists onto Singer Island as possible. And the only way we can do that is if we have a beach.
A 2015 study by the State Office of Economic and Demographic Research found that Florida's beaches are its number one tourist attraction. Despite that, Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvala says the state isn't doing enough to protect them.
Over half our beaches are considered eroded, and only half of those eroded beaches are part of Project Solutions.
This session, Latvala helped secure $50 million to restore about 26 beaches. It's now up to the governor to approve the projects. Diana Ferguson says the funds would help local governments afford some of the top priority projects.
St. John's County for their shore protection project, and then Gulf County for the St. Joe Peninsula beach nourishment. Bay County is also going to receive funding, as well as Sunny Isles in Miami-Dade County.
When voters approved a sweeping environmental trust fund in 2014, dedicated funding disappeared for dredging and carting in offshore sand. Since then, the backlog of projects has been growing, says Ferguson.
There were a few years there where we were seeing a $100 million list, maybe only funding, you know, $30 million and coming back and seeing that same list again or that same amount.
The legislature failed to pass a bill that would have revamped the way the state decides which projects get funding. The plan would have incorporated more data in the process and prioritized inlet management. Even with $50 million worth of restoration and another $13.3 million to repair roads in Flagler and St. John's counties, beach erosion will continue. That's according to George Weatherly, an emeritus professor of oceanography at Florida State University.
I'm glad to see that they've funded more restoration. The problem will mitigate for a few years, and then we'll be back there again.
Weatherly himself owns property on a canal just off the Gulf Coast, and he's been starting his own projects.
You know, put rocks to kind of keep the erosion back, but eventually the sea level's going to come over the rocks and going to come up to the surface. Then what am I going to do? Put land on it? You know, bring fill dirt in to raise the level? I don't know. I'll cross that bridge when I have to. Or maybe it'll be my son's problem, you know.
Weatherly says Florida's beaches are sort of like a great old car. You love it and take care of it and fix it as long as you can. But eventually, it can't keep running the way you want. We'll always have beaches, Weatherly says, just maybe not where we want them. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson just left an Arctic Council meeting in Anchorage without saying whether the U.S. will pull out of the Paris Accords. But activists say Florida should be worried about the latest reports on the loss of sea ice and permafrost. Jim Ash has more.
Tillerson didn't drop any bombshells at the Anchorage meeting, but he hinted the U.S. might pull the plug on the Paris Agreement.
We're not going to rush to make a decision. We're going to work to make the right decision for the United States.
Former State Department negotiator turned climate change activist Rafe Pomerantz says pulling out of the Paris Accord would be very bad news for Florida. Now, Pomerantz chairs a group called Arctic 21. He points to new research showing that sea ice and permafrost are melting faster than previous predictions and threatening an increase in sea level rise.
The fate of Greenland is the fate of Miami. Citizenry of the rest of the country has a stake in what happens in the Arctic.
Floridians can no longer afford to ignore the latest bad news coming from the top of the globe, Pomerantz says.
Sea level rise is an existential threat to Florida, and the Arctic is one of the big drivers of that.
The Arctic Council's latest report is called SWIPA, for snow, water, ice, and permafrost in the Arctic. Among the findings is that the Arctic Ocean could be completely free of ice in the summer as early as 2030. NASA scientist Walt Meyer, a primary author, says that's as much as 50 years earlier than the models predicted just a decade ago.
You know, that's going from something that young kids today maybe would see in their lifetime, more likely their children or grandchildren would see, to something that, you know, young kids will almost assuredly see in their lifetime.
Meyer says that means sea level rise will also be worse. Instead of rising by an average of 32 to 45 centimeters by 2100, the new projection is between 52 and 74 centimeters. The range depends on whether nations follow the greenhouse gas limits set by the Paris Agreement. Meyer says the extra foot would be noticed.
That can make a big difference. That could be the difference between a bad storm and a catastrophic storm in terms of flood damage and things like that.
Meyer agrees Florida can escape the fallout from a more rapidly warming Arctic.
Glaciers in Greenland are melting and losing ice faster than expected, and there are new pathways to lose ice. And that, of course, has direct ramifications on coastal areas like Miami that are near sea level.
Meyer calls the SWIPA report concerning.
Based on what we've been seeing changing in our state of knowledge over the last 10 to 15 years, that is a little bit scary because, as we find out more, it seems to be getting worse and worse.
Earlier this week, Senate Democratic Leader Oscar Brainin of Miami participated in a climate change forum in Fort Lauderdale, organized by young activists and environmental groups like Moms Clean Air Force. The forum focused on the effects of climate change on minority communities. Brainin says it's ironic that President Donald Trump wants to pull out of the Paris Agreement, especially considering that his beloved winter White House is in Palm Beach.
Mar-a-Lago would be underwater. The Trump Hotel on Sunny Isles would be underwater. He owns a lot of property that will be directly affected by this climate change.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Florida's hospitals are intently watching the negotiations between the state and federal government over health care funding. Florida has been talking to federal officials about renewing a program helping fund health care services for low-income Floridians. Sarah Mueller has the latest.
Talks with the Donald Trump administration on federal funding to Florida have dragged on since March. Governor Rick Scott secured a promise for about $1 billion in federal medical needy money from the federal government. State legislators cut more than $500 million in state Medicaid funding to hospitals based on that promise. Bruce Rubin of the Florida Hospital Association says Justin Senior, who heads the Agency for Healthcare Administration, or ACA, told lawmakers the low-income pool would cover the Medicaid cuts.
That the representations that the Secretary Senior made to the legislature, that the low-income pool would be $1.5 billion, and that the hospitals would not be harmed by taking the general revenue, we hope those representations are indeed what happened.
LIP is federal money the state matches through local government revenue. The state needs to raise $500 million from willing local governments to match the $1 billion in federal funding. Florida health officials and the Trump administration are working out the terms and conditions under which Florida would get the money. Rubin says it could take till the end of June or longer for a deal. The state has missed previous deadlines for an agreement. Lobbyist Jennifer Ungrew was previously a top member of ACA. She says she hopes the LIP money will make up for the state funding cuts. But she says even if it doesn't cover all the reductions, hospitals still have to treat the sick.
Well, I would hope that it doesn't mean that people have less access to care. Hospitals can't turn folks away. That's kind of the whole purpose of having a safety net.
But hospitals want to know who's going to pay for that care if the patient can't. Florida didn't expand Medicaid to cover the nearly 900,000 low-income Floridians who would have been eligible for coverage. The Hospital Association's Bruce Rubin says the cuts could lead to less access to medical services, fewer staff hired, and higher insurance premiums. While the LIP funding may mitigate the impacts of the cuts, Rubin says they will still be felt.
The individual hospitals have to certainly prepare for the consequence of these cuts, and then they have to make it clear to their communities and to our lawmakers what those consequences are. And we won't know for sure until we know the terms and conditions of the low-income pool.
Rubin says another threat to hospitals is Congress. He believes the issue of uncompensated care will grow if Congress reduces the number of people eligible to get health insurance. But lobbyist Jennifer Ungrew says she thinks Congress is more focused on coverage than on the drivers of cost.
Yet she says she's excited for the state to have more flexibility to create a customized Medicaid program.
The way that we're going to make healthcare more accessible is if it's affordable.
The Congressional Budget Office said tens of millions of people would lose coverage through the original House version of repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. There's not yet a CBO score on the version that passed the U.S. House of Representatives. That version could increase insurance premiums for older people and waive coverage requirements for states. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Finally tonight, Governor Rick Scott has signed a body camera-related bill into law, but as Sasha Cordner tells us, while it has the support of Florida's law enforcement groups, others continue to have reservations.
Let's say there's a use of force incident and it turns violent when the officer and another person get into an altercation. The Florida Police Benevolent Association's Matt Puckett says in that case, having a body camera is helpful for several reasons.
The officer has to recount, you know, what happened with some detail, you know, where the blows came from, who threw the blows, where each blow landed. You know, I don't know how many of the listeners have been in a fight in a long time, but that, you know, that's a hard thing to recount, especially in a report, especially if there is a potential civil suit or a serious criminal charge being leveled against either the suspect or the officer.
Puckett says allowing officers to review the footage before writing a report or making a statement is crucial for accuracy and transparency, and they can do that now under a bill just signed into law by the governor.
So there's always this apprehension that we're trying to give some kind of advantage to the law enforcement officer, but in reality, we're really not. These cameras are already in cars. It's a practice that you review your dash cam footage beforehand.
The new law would not apply if there's an active crime scene or if a suspect needs to be identified right away. But despite the backing of the Florida Police Benevolent Association, the Florida Sheriff's Association, and the Florida Police Chiefs Association, some lawmakers on both sides of the aisle expressed concerns throughout the legislative process. State Representative Chevron Jones says he still has concerns. For the past couple of years, the West Park Democrat has filed body camera bills, but he didn't sponsor the new law.
When the PBA came to me and shared with me that there was a type of body camera bill that would allow the police officers to view footage prior to it becoming public, I still have some heartache about that, because nowhere within that language did it say who's watching that footage with you. How do you ensure that an individual is not tampering with the footage that they're watching? And that worries me.
And while the measure did pass unanimously in both the House and Senate, Jones says he was just a reluctant yes vote.
In good faith, I voted for it because the sponsor and the PBA at that time assured me that the bill did not do that and the integrity of the process would be upheld. I don't know how much I believe that. It scares me that there are still bad actors in every sector. And I'm afraid that there can be some unintended consequences in that.
The new law takes effect July 1st. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back next week. Please join us each Friday for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.